I'm Margaret Feinberg, and this is The Joycast. I don't know about you, but I've been struggling to process all that I've been thinking and feeling during this time. And whenever I have a struggle like that, my first lifeline is the phone a friend, because I want to find somebody who is wiser, who knows more, who recognizes and can provide wisdom and insight into what I'm seeing and wrestling with. And so I want to introduce you to Kent Annan. And he's not only one of the most spectacular writers and thinkers I know, with such grace and gentleness and compassion, but he's also director of the humanitarian and disaster at Wheaton College. His work in Haiti before and after the earthquake and in communities around the world equip him to offer insight into what we're facing and wrestling with now. His books, You Welcomed Me, Slow Kingdom, and Aftershock are gifts to us all. So join me in welcoming Kent Annan to The Joycast. Kent, it is such a delight to have you on The Joycast.
No, it's great, great, great to be with you, Margaret.
Now, you have a little bit of an unusual position in that you are a guru, an expert of sorts in kind of humanitarian care and disaster relief. Can you tell my listeners just kind of how that evolved, how you came to study and know it in that space?
Yeah, my very first job was working with refugees. So I graduated from college, moved to England and France, and worked with refugees for 2 years. And I thought that was going to be like my quick Peace Corps stint and then on to other ideas I had, but it became what I've done kind of for the last 25 years. So worked with refugees for a couple of years, came back for grad school. The day after grad school, went to work in Albania, where there was a refugee crisis in Kosovo. The war was happening. Then came back and got married. Then my wife and I moved to Haiti, lived in a little tin roof, no running water, no electricity, home in Haiti for 2.5 years, and moved back and then had an NGO that was working in Haiti on education. But then the earthquake happened 10 years ago. And then found ourselves in this kind of disaster situation, similar but different from refugees. And then 2 years ago, I started working with Wheaton College, and I would have been happy to keep doing that kind of work. But then Wheaton was launching a new Master of Arts in Humanitarian and Disaster Leadership. And I'd been doing this kind of work. I'd written books about this kind of work along the way, and just thought it was too much of God's calling in life and too much of an opportunity to give up to get to work with kind of other people who are going into this kind of work. So that's a quick sketch over what led me to being able to work with colleagues in moments like this to try to serve the church and people who are facing this COVID-19 crisis.
So for a number of people, this is the first real crisis of sorts that they may have experienced in their lives. There are others for whom they have had so many crises, so much pain, battling diseases, divorce, death of loved ones. But for some, this is a brand new space. What are some of the emotional and psychological responses that we often have to disaster?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I actually have been working with my colleague Jamie Ayton on this. He's done research, and it's kind of confirms my experience that I've done more on the field work, but we actually have come up with these five different categories often that people are feeling, exactly what you said, this emotional and spiritual stress in these moments. One is a belonging, and especially with this physical separating, like a loss of belonging that can happen in like you said, all kinds of different hardships and suffering we face, but in this unique way right now with COVID-19. Another is livelihood, you know, just with the staggering losses of job, you know, of employment right now, and then other people who just have lost part of their income and uncertainty ahead. And then the emotional, sort of the stresses of mental health stresses or depression and anxiety that can skyrocket. And then there are the spiritual and safety issues. So safety is, you know, we can, as we're discombobulated, you know, think about a refugee in one way of like their safety is now they're sleeping out in the bush. Like I've known friends who have walked outside for days to get somewhere safe, or, you know, they have all these extreme safety issues. But for us in this moment, you know, it's safety issues of, I was just at the grocery store a couple hours ago and was wearing a mask, and most people were wearing masks. And so we have these new safety issues in our lives. And then the spiritual is often we do ask these questions of meaning and doubt and faith in new ways that just get sort of, I wrote a book called Aftershock, but they sort of, it feels like there's an earthquake, you know, in our lives. And we seek to understand what we think about meaning and faith and God in the aftershocks that come after. So that's a quick survey, but I think those are some of the ways that we do get, like you said, that these events, it's this virus, but it also affects us in a really holistic way in our lives.
Is there a pattern at all for what we're feeling and sensing in this that you've seen in other disasters that you've studied?
I don't know I think there's a pattern that will come of sort of that, like there's the preparedness like they talk about, and then there's the immediate response afterwards, and then it enters a kind of relief stage, and then there's kind of recovery and moving into kind of back into development. So that's one framework of thinking of these, like the before, the during, the immediate aftermath, and then the sort of recovery and rebuilding towards what's ahead. So I think that might be a little helpful to think, okay, this is such a unique event in a way, because often the disaster is something that takes, it might take in the earthquake in Haiti, 34 seconds. I can't remember exactly, that's like a 34 second event. A hurricane is maybe a 3-day event, but this is this prolonged, like weeks, months, we don't know what the end game is. So I think if we can think a little bit in terms of, okay, we're all discombobulated right now because we're still right in it. And that's normal in a disaster. And then there's going to be this shift towards things. It's like the new normal, as people are saying, that we can kind of shift into, okay, this is the kind of relief stage. We're getting out of this. We're pulling through. And then after that, it's more the long-term development. And I think that's a way of thinking about what I've worked on is more like development, international development, how we help people. But I think there's an element of that that's true, and I have to be careful because I'm not a psychologist, but I think there is an element of that we can see in our own lives. And then one other thing with how you asked is great, and these different stages of, sort of it's a scramble and then it's the grieving. And I felt myself going through these different stages too. And I've heard some people talk about that, and it feels like depending on what age people are, that there are these different events in our lives, like 9/11 can be one, and for others, it might be in a different war. It could be these different things where there's a grief of loss of everything from, graduation to plans to a writing project to some, a birthday party, like all these things, these little losses. But then there's also, I think, a loss of and shifting of what the world is, that's kind of deeper and hard to articulate. But I think that's something that many of us are going through as well.
And so right now we're in more of that relief stage of kind of than the recovery or stages. Does that feel about accurate?
Yeah, exactly. Or even in the, depending where we live, it's almost in the disaster still, right? So I think it's, and different people and as families, again, this is this fast moving in some ways, slow moving in other ways. And the moment of disaster for some people probably are listening now too, is like when you're furloughed from your job or, these different things happen. So this is this, it's our first time we've had ever in any of our lives experienced this where it's global, but it's also going to really hit each of us in different ways, emotionally, spiritually, but then in terms of livelihood and all these other things too, that will have a big impact on our lives.
And that the disaster, like you said, it's not just a single quake. We did have an earthquake here, like many places around the country and world in the midst of this, but it's not just that. It is, it is financial. It can be relational. It can be the isolation. It can be. And so it can, and then get it, many of my friends have the virus or are getting past the virus or, are in intense situations with the virus. And so it is a rolling kind of experience. And the difference of, my father-in-law and mother-in-law live in Sitka, Alaska. And right now, as of 2 hours ago, this could change in 30 minutes. There's not a case there identified yet. But that can shift in just a second. And so it's a wild sideways feeling experience. What encouragement do you have for those who know, I have got to rise up among the resilient in this? What wisdom do you have for those listeners?
Yeah, I think one is, I talked about this in one of my other books. Like I wrote this book called Slow Kingdom Coming, and it was kind of my wrestling with working in Haiti and other places where change happens slowly. And so for me, I've been thinking about it some anew during this time. And so I think about Jesus' prayer. So Jesus 2000 years ago prayed, you know, in Our Father, you know, thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. And then think, wow, like 2000 years later, like Jesus prayed this, Jesus taught us to pray this, and it's not come true yet. Like it's not fully realized yet, this prayer. And so this is a slow kingdom coming. And so I think this part of what we are brought face to face with, again, is that this is a slow kingdom coming. And I in my work and reflecting and talking with people and studying scripture, kind of think, oh, are there these three stages to kind of being resilient in moments like this? And one is to lament, you know, that too many people suffer too much for too long. And in this moment, it's on the headlines, it's friends, it's family, it's ourselves, it's our spouses, like whatever it is, like you mentioned, that it can be jobs, it can be sickness. So we lament, and it does feel like this is a time to slow down enough to lament. I had a conversation with a theologian yesterday, and he was kind of walking through the Holy Week, and it felt like a gift to me because it made me slow down just to think through, oh, this, you know, the Easter and the Monday, Thursday, and a Good Friday, and into Easter, and thinking, oh, we need to slow down and not rush right to Easter, you know, but to take time on Good Friday, on Holy Saturday, as, you know, not just on that weekend, but on in our lives as people of faith, and then lament. But then we don't stay in lament. Then I think it's a move towards hope and thinking, what is my hope? Where is my hope rooted? And in faith in God, and also I think hope is rooted in that God puts us here for each other to help each other out through hard circumstances. So kind of reflecting on hope and thinking about hope, and then the third step to me, so lament and hope, but not just staying in that, but then what is my commitment then? And then lament, hope, and what is my commitment to be on the side of that hope and to participate in God's kingdom coming? And so so then I think, how am I going to help my neighbor? How am I going to use my gifts to help out people in my church who are vulnerable? Or, you know, if you're a writer, to write something, if you're a singer, to sing, if you're a nurse, to be doing your job that's so hard right now. And so, so to me, kind of running through that rubric of lament and hope and commitment kind of helps me when I do feel discouraged and facing, you know, not facing anything quite like this, but have faced other things that at least have some resonance with this moment we're facing.
What are some of the ways that you've seen or heard of people reaching out and making a difference? I know for my husband and I who are quarantined, you know, there's a lot of things. It was hard. We took a walk in our neighborhood and we saw a family moving in, and we would have loved to have helped them move in and carry all their stuff. And we can't. And it's almost painful at times for all the things we can't do. I know for us, one of the small things we can do is whenever, you know, we are able to buy groceries, we make sure to make a donation to our local food bank, because we know there are those who don't have the ability. What are some of the things that you're seeing that each of us can do to engage healthily in this time, serving and making that commitment to others?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's actually been one of the privileges of doing the kind of work that we do in the Humanitarian Disaster Institute now, and then this church planning manual that my colleague Jamie Aiton and I wrote is, we've heard from all kinds of churches doing incredible things. Like there's been this suffering that's, we're just at the front end in some ways because of the economic ramifications that will keep going. But man, I have to say, I've been so encouraged. I think the way churches have responded so creatively to continuing to be worshiping communities and seeing their high-tech churches with four cameras and systems on the go already working, but then to see small churches going to FaceTime Live or recording something for YouTube. So I think one thing that's been encouraging is people working on worship to help each other out. I've seen and heard about different people working with refugee communities. So it's a community that I really care about and worked with a lot over my vocation. And so I heard about, talked with a refugee pastor here in Chicagoland area. He came from South Sudan. And so I was talking with him And he said two things. He said, one, please reach out. We could, like, it's great. Churches are reaching out. Like you said, Margaret, sort of some of these communities are more vulnerable, so they need information or help with food bank issues and some really practical things like that, where they might need someone to help shop for them or they're not getting all the information they need. And then I loved, he said, but, and also we've been able to encourage others because we know loss already. Like we've gone through loss, like we lost everything and, you know, and walked and escaped and lost families and had no home and started over. And I thought that was really beautiful that I wasn't thinking in that way. Like I've experienced in some ways, but I wasn't thinking about it in this moment and thinking, wow, there are refugees or undocumented workers or others who can, I think, be a source of spiritual strength for us right now. If we have ears to listen. And then I think the practical things, like, I don't know if you're in your neighborhood there, but it's been great seeing in our neighborhood, different families have written Bible verses out in chalk on the sidewalk. And one we did as a family, they had set up this really elaborate sort of thing where you're supposed to hopscotch and then spin three times and then count on these different numbers, like all on the sidewalk. It was almost for a full block, where we took like half an hour to do this sort of almost playground, chalk playground that they had set up on there. So I thought it was a really beautiful example of being neighbors. So everything from those like little bursts of joy to really serious things like who's food insecure, who are the older adults in your neighborhood, who can the church and the city government and everybody can kind of rally around to make sure they're getting what they need.
So good. And also, I think one of the things that I'm saying that's exciting is in the churches, some of them, it's almost like God has already pre-positioned them. I have an amazing friend, Lori Wilhite, at Central Church in Las Vegas, and you know they've had a food pantry. And so this happens, and all the food pantries in that area shut down except for their church and one other, I think, in that area of Vegas. And so, you know, they've got cars lined up for, you know, 3 and 4 hours waiting for, you know, access to food. And they said last year, I think they distributed about 300,000 pounds of food in the last 3 weeks, 3-4 weeks, they've already done 2 million. And so she's like, this little thing that we had, a food pantry right now, is just, you know, being used in amazing ways. And seeing that there are places and people who it feels like, you know, have been divinely positioned for this moment, to be able to speak in and provide and be part of the larger team and community pouring out and serving.
I love that you said that. Can I jump in for a second? So one of the things in this church planning manual that Jamie and I did is we say, as you think about responding for a church, think about how, like what your strengths are or how God has already gifted you. And we've kind of found studying and working in this area that the best responses that are sustained for the long term are exactly what you just said there about your friend. It's that when churches don't try to become like a new center for disease control or a mini health clinic, but it's what are we called to now? And I think this works for families as well. Like what are our gifts? Where do we find joy in serving others? Where have we already been doing work? And if that's a food pantry, that's a perfect example. And I think other churches I know that work with like, families of undocumented workers, that's a special ability and language and trust where they can go right into that. So nobody, no family or no church can do everything. Like this is too big. But I think if we pivot right into, and it's great, you've written about joy and I've loved your writing about joy in the past and talking about joy. But I think if we pivot into this place of where we're gifted and where we find joy in serving, that's probably where we're best equipped to serve right now too.
It's so good. And the creative ways to show love toward each other in this time. You I believe have met our little pup Hershey before and he passed away and it was not delightful at all. But it was interesting in this context to watch how people loved us well. To watch the people who lots of people sent letters and emails, and that was really encouraging, but also the ones who would like grab their phone and make a little video and send that, or find a picture of Hershey on their phone and send that, or come to our yard with a sign that just says, we love you, or send flowers. And it's amazing in how this season, those things meant so much more. And that there are acts of compassion and kindness, and I see you, and you're not alone in this. It just, man, it's deeply meaningful.
Yeah, it's bringing out something beautiful too, we have to say, in the midst of this, which is another thing that's not unusual in disasters, that there is this kind of beauty and generosity. I think there always can be a handful of people exploiting moments, but there can overwhelmingly be a beauty and generosity that comes out in moments like this. I had a colleague say, I think it was yesterday or the day before, was her husband's birthday, and so they're in a small like house church. I'm not sure the exact, 15 or 20 people, and so they're already doing house church, but this church was going to come by, and I've seen a couple of these on Twitter or YouTube of kind of the parades of people honking, as they go by to say hi and happy birthday. And he said their group all got out of their cars, kept a good safe 10 feet from each other. And by, I guess someone bought like a stereo system or cranked it up in their car. And people ranging from teens up into their 60s did a disco dance for her husband's birthday. And she just said the joy that, and all of them were kind of emailing afterwards and just thought, like seeing each other from this distance, but there was just this incredible meaningfulness and joy and uplift of spirits that happened. Like you said, we're saying because of the creativity of loving each other that's finding new expression in this moment.
In the five stages of grief, you've got denial and anger and bargaining and depression and acceptance. And then there's the sixth, which is a meaning. And from your study of disasters, I'm under the camp that like we never thank God for a disaster. Like you don't thank God for cancer. I don't. Or let me rephrase that. I don't consider cancer a gift, because cancer is something you don't want to give to someone else. And so I would never want to give COVID-19 to someone. I would never. And yet in that, there are still gifts to be found. How do we posture our lives in such a way that we can discover perhaps meaning or insight or the gifts that are tucked into such pain and hardship and suffering?
Yeah. First, I love how you frame that. I feel the same way, that these aren't a gift. And I would also say, I think maybe, I don't know, these get theologically difficult, but I don't think they're gifts from God. These are not gifts from God that to kind of have some people suffer so others of us can be discipled better. So I agree with you there. And it's also a really hard question. I think for me, what I've found going through this and knowing it's so big and complex, that kind of speaking personally, like the way I've done it and seen it with people I've worked with is making sure, I'll just give a list of a few examples that helped me in the past and now. It's like pausing for gratitude. It's a simple thing that we talk about, we know is healthy psychologically for us, but pausing for gratitude. Like our team worked really hard on some projects, and it was still right in the middle of this, but we kind of paused for 30 minutes in one team meeting just to say that we are grateful and to sort of do a mini celebration, because we felt like we had served hard, worked hard, and it was in the context of no denial about how hard everything was. We thought, okay, we need to kind of stop and be grateful and say, okay, we've done our best. We tried to serve God and people were supposed to serve well here. So I think those kind of small things, and something I teach my master's students that I found really helpful. And when my books, when I wrote while I was responding to the earthquake is, really for me, reading the Psalms and writing my own Psalms. So I teach our students how to write a Psalm, kind of give them a sort of step-by-step based on the Psalms of how to go through. But to me, what's so helpful in finding meaning and going through this is the Psalms will give me and give us a voice for anger in this moment. It'll give words for doubt, like how long, O Lord? Literally, how long will this keep going? If you're living in New York City right now, if you're a nurse in the ER that's overwhelmed, like how long, O Lord? How long? And sort of give voice to that. And then I did this the other day. We're reading a psalm at family dinners. We've gotten better at family dinners. I have an 11-year-old and 14-year-old at home, and different activities, can kind of push in on dinners for different tennis practice or, whatever happens. So we've been good at doing family dinners and slowing down a little bit more. And so we've been reading a psalm every night. And so we were reading Psalm 13 was where we were, and reading the psalms together. And my kids read, and I thought of, oh, this thing I think I learned in C.S. Lewis's book, Reflection on the Psalms, where, I don't know about for you, but for me, in the Psalms, the harsh speaking about the enemies can trip me up sometimes, you know, because it's the love your enemies part of Jesus, and then smash your enemies part of the Psalms can be a little disconcerting sometimes. Like, how do I work this out? But like 20 years ago, I read C.S. Lewis, and he talked about how he could put in the place of enemies to think about sin and suffering there. And I'm not quoting him exactly, but to think about sin and think about suffering, that's what we want to be vanquished. So my daughter read the Psalm, and I grabbed it and thought, and each place I sort of replaced coronavirus or COVID-19 in a place where it said the enemy, I found like it sort of, we were like making meaning together, like your question, like we're making meaning together as a family around the dinner table, as we were voicing at the beginning of that Psalm, like, how long, oh Lord, are you going to be away forever? Like, what's going to happen? And then moving towards faith, but it's saying, you know, crush my enemies, like crush this thing that's making so many people suffering, and let us through to praise at the end. So sorry, I'm kind of rambling a little bit here, but I think these are just some of these ways where there's no formula for making meaning, but I think we want to create that space for lament, for seeking, and how have other people found words in the past, and those can those help us find words that for things that are so hard to understand. And in that, if we're also doing this together virtually or with people we're living with, then I think this is a way to make it through. And like you said, there are ways we can make it through and be stronger and more resilient on the other side.
So good. So good. Kent, I love your writing, and my listeners know that I don't say that a ton. Very often about my guests, but man, Kent's writing is some of the most lovely, beautiful, stunning. It is just phenomenal. And one of the things that we do, Kent, on the Joycast is we love to ask our guests for a recipe, and it can be a recipe for life or for something you cook or for navigating difficult times. And just wanted to see what practical wisdom you'd love to leave our listeners with.
I know I jumped in too early then with that, because I think that's the recipe I want to kind of leave you with, is to go to the Psalms. I'd say start with Psalm 13. I think Psalm 3 works really well. And I think this is super practical right this moment. And you might feel, if you're listening, like, oh, is this going to be like, oh, I don't have to read this out loud, or what do I do, or this, or do I change the words of scripture? But I think that the enemies that we're called into, like, so my encouragement is to go with confidence. You don't have to do it on Facebook Live to start, to do it in your own privacy, and to read one of these Psalms. Start with maybe Psalm 3, then go to Psalm 13. And the recipe there is to, every time it says something like enemies or foes, or, you know, this thing that should be conquered. And it, you know, for me, I picture, you know, David facing a rebellious army, or, you know, there's a back and forth, and there's spears might be flying. So, but for us to think about coronavirus and to think about the possibility of death, and to think about our neighbor's suffering. And I think if you read it through, that's my encouragement. Read through the Psalm, plug that in, experiment with it. Like, what happened to me is not just like, I knew this, but I didn't really do it until I'd done it with my family the other night at dinner. And when we did it, it transformed everything about the Psalm, like not just those words, but I felt like I was finding, in a way, finding my prayers for this moment for the first time. And so kind of a recipe to you and like for your listeners. And my hope is too, that what that adds is it's this recipe that we can be honest about our faith with God. I know you're great at this, Margaret, is encouraging this, like honest in the joys, but are honest in the sorrows. But I hope that can be a practical way to do that, and that can be something that can be meaningful in this moment to do together, and that maybe it then can carry on beyond this coronavirus time and be something that's meaningful in your life, to have a really honest faith that's resilient and it's not hiding from the suffering, but that is also finding lots of joy.
Thank you, Kent. Thank you for your wisdom, your insight, and thank you for being on the Joycast.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Margaret.